I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. 25 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was the beginning of the end of the Soviet communist system in Russia and Eastern Europe, we're taking the measure of the strongman's successor. Vladimir Putin came out of the ruins and a short-lived democracy movement to rule the roost in Moscow and Petersburg for almost 15 years now. This is the man who says, Russia is my life, who says there's no going back, but that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the major geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. He says the United States has botched its power monopoly in a diverse world, that our dominance is descending toward war and or anarchy. We're talking about the man who embodies the threat, for some people the allure, of a new bipolarity in the world, maybe a new Cold War. We begin with the journalist Anna Arutunyan, who's both Russian and Oklahoma American in her upbringing. She was educated at NYU. She's been a writer and editor. She quit the semi-official Moscow News last March. Her book on the Putin mystique is critical. At the same time, it puts Putin's booming approval rate at home in the context of Russian psychology and history. Then David Filipov, who covered the war in Chechnya and other disasters of the Putin era for the Boston Globe. He was in Moscow for the Globe last summer, covering the annexation of Crimea. And then the scholar Mary Elise Sarati is going to pull back to the wider frame of the whole era since 1989, to the American promises not to crowd Russia after the fall of its empire, and all the missed opportunities that brought us and them to Putin. First, here is Vladimir Putin in a translator's voice, but it's the sound of his mind at work and the way he sees the world.
Maybe the exceptionalism of the United States, that is, the way they implement their leadership, is it really beneficial to everybody? And their constant interference in all the world's affairs brings peace, well-being, progress, democracy? And we should just relax and enjoy? I will allow myself to say it is not this way. It is not at all this way. The unilateral diktat and the imposing of schemes have exactly the opposite effect.
Anna Arutunyan, we admire your book, The Putin Mystique. Take apart that word mystique.
Thank you for the admiration. The mystique, as I saw, and I was studying Russian society to write this book for a couple of years and just going through various case studies, I see it basically as a reflection of how people want to be ruled, not how they think they want to be ruled, but how they actually want to be ruled, because there is a difference there. And in that sense, it's not quite populism in the sense that he's giving he's giving people popular policies in order to be reelected, because we're not really talking about an electoral system here. It's rather a more primitive relationship between the ruler and their people, whereby he has to reflect the various interests, which often contradict each other, in order to stay in power and govern the country.
But what is it that people like, especially in this strange year of 2014?
What is it they like?
Including the Sochi Olympics and Crimea. And sort of the bear looking over Ukraine. What is it that people are responding to?
Well, we did see his his popularity surge as a result of Russia's incursion and its involvement in Ukraine. I think that there was, for several years, there had been some disenchantment. There had been an anti-corruption drive spearheaded by President Medvedev's administration. Of course, during that time, Putin was still in power as prime minister, so he hadn't really gone anywhere. It wasn't like he wasn't in power. But nevertheless, because this topic was brought up, I think Russians were disenchanted with, they basically realized, well, okay, our country is still corrupt. Even the government is talking about what's really the point. There was no grandeur, and I had while I was researching my book, I had several I had one former FSB officer actually told me, well, what's our point? What's the point of governance? What's the big idea? Is it to hold the Sochi Winter Olympics? And I think after that, I think the government even before then was realizing that, you know, what's going to happen next after Sochi? What's the big idea? And Ukraine emerged as that big idea, I think.
Start at the beginning of this story. For me, it's so dramatically a boyhood in the wreckage of Leningrad, St. Petersburg, and the parents who had been shattered by the Nazi siege of their city in World War II.
Well, yes. I mean, Putin, who was born in 1952, he kind of encompasses many of the complexes of his generation. This is the post-war generation of a country that saw itself as basically defeating ultimate evil. This is an issue that's still alive today. The defeat of Nazism for Russia is an extremely, it's both a traumatic experience and almost a religious one. Nevertheless, society, the post-war years were, even considering everything else that had happened before the war and the Soviet regime in general, it was kind of this austere, I wouldn't say colorless. I mean, maybe there was some color in their lives, but in many ways, it was a very survivalist attitude that people grew up with. And I think for Putin, that has played a very important role.
He's a street fighter growing up and a nasty one. He's a KGB bureaucrat as a young man. Place him, Anna, in Germany, in Dresden, when the Berlin Wall is coming down. One sense is that he is still sickened by that expression in Germany of people power and by the Soviets' helplessness. He calls it paralysis in the face of that revolt.
I think here we shouldn't overestimate his response to people power. I think what happened in Dresden while he was in Germany, I think what happened generally with the collapse of the Soviet Union and why this traumatized him was not so much that he is particularly personally averse to people power, but the fact that he joined the KGB seeing it as endowed with this idea of loyalty and order and the idea of serving a quasi-divine government, which Russia has always had in some form or another. And what happened with the collapse of that is that that government sort of ceased to be. He was waiting for orders. There's even a quote. He was waiting for orders from Moscow. Those orders never came. And I saw that.
What orders to do what?
To do something, anything. What's happening? What are we going to do? What's going to happen to us? And I saw a lot of former KGB officers expressing the same dismay. What are we going to live for now that this is gone? We had an idea. I mean, we might have disagreed with it, but it was at least something. And then what? Is it just to make money? What's this about? And I think that was the central negative experience for him there.
You know, in China, you can hear it said that the official Chinese view of that period in Russia was that they lost their nerve. And at the time of Tiananmen Square, the Chinese were going to be damned if they gave up, you know, even at a terrific price. Does that make sense?
It does. It doesn't. And I think it makes sense now in the context of what happened in Ukraine. I think Putin sees he's actually been critical of former President Yanukovych for not taking a firmer stand on the protests. I mean, basically, yeah. If Putin is averse to violent regime change, this did have a traumatizing effect on him back in the day. So that we can see how that aversion stems from that. Sure.
So, bringing it into his political career. He wins his spurs with the democracy movement in a fashion. I remember that at the time, he was very close to the reform mayor of Petersburg, Mayor Sobchak, and then adopted by the oligarch, taken to be a reformist, Boris Berezovsky. How did that happen?
Well, because once the Soviet Union collapsed, and once a lot of former KGB officers like him, they actually were in great demand by the new society for their contacts. Basically, they were very helpful for the new businesses that were forming, because they had the connections, they had they were moving money, and it was just this tumultuous time in Soviet and post-Soviet society. It saw a lot of these KGB officers finding themselves in various new either businesses or in Putin's case as the deputy to Sobchak. And notice here that like Sobchak, being a Democrat, this didn't really stop Putin from working for him, because this was not based on ideology or preferences for democracy or not. Putin at that point, like many in his at that point in their careers, was an opportunist, as a lot of people were. And it's not that he had it, that he was particularly averse to democracy. So yes, he saw his work for Sobchak as an opportunity. And,
we'll come back to that. There's still some mystery about why he was chosen, whether any other guy out of the KGB might have become Putin. Coming up, the darker sides of Vladimir Putin that Russian people seem to love. Here was Barbara Walters with President Putin trying back in the day to tease out some of his sinister self.
I'm going to ask you a terrible question. Did you ever order anyone killed?
No. In fact, my work was more intellectual, political information gathering, analysis, and so forth. So thank God, nothing like that happened to me.
I have seen too many movies. You were the judo champion in Leningrad.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Vladimir Putin, at the top of the heap in Russia for almost 15 years, is a legend in his own mind, but getting to be a bigger, more menacing figure in the mind of Europe and recently in the U.S. We've heard Anna Arutunyan's outline of the story. It's David Filipov's turn. Boston-born, he was a student in Russia during the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s, which became the start of a big career at the Boston Globe, covering what seemed the promising Yeltsin years, the rise of Putin, the decline of the reformist era. David, I remember so well reading you on the wars in Chechnya and feeling then, but now even more so, that it was the beginning of something utterly awful.
That's right. You mentioned President Yeltsin. There was this hope that in Russia and in the United States that Russia was going to be a great big democracy, a friend. We were going to help them. They were grateful. They were happy. Communism was gone. Then President Boris Yeltsin is impeached by a parliament that was democratically elected, but it was communists and fascists. And when he blew them away with tanks, we were in favor of that. Then there was a rebellion in Chechnya. What is the new democratic Russia going to do? And when it turned into this war of attrition, cities were flattened. There were massacres. There were atrocities. Mm. True, the Chechens, increasingly Islamic, increasingly jihadist, also committed atrocities. But the people who suffered were the thousands and thousands of civilians, many of them ethnic Russians, who lived in those cities. And we saw, wait a sec, the new democratic Russia doesn't look very good. It looks worse than the old Soviet Union. It's blowing away its own people. What a shock.
There was a kind of personal bloodthirstiness about it. And reading the lives now of Vladimir Putin, something awful emerged out of him. What was it?
Well, when Putin comes to power, he comes to power as the prime minister, and his first job is end the war in Chechnya. And when he steps up to the plate, it's clear that the guy has a populist bent. He says something that people still remember, we'll rub them out in the outhouses. It kind of had the same ring as George Bush's Bring 'Em On or Mission Accomplished. And he takes control of that effort, and it wipes out the cities that were left standing, the places that were left standing in Chechnya. And you have this immediate equation, if this is what you're getting at, that solving the problem with brute force is going to work. And not only that, Putin's going to become extremely popular for it.
You were in Moscow this past summer, and you wrote that part of what you saw was a country gone mad in the Crimea test, but maybe ever since Chechnya.
Well, you know, that actually was a quote of a friend of mine in response to some of the crazy laws that are being passed by a parliament that no one elects anymore. They're basically appointed. And some of these things, you know, bans on lingerie and, you know, bans on statues that have private parts showing for nothing, for, you know, like ancient classical statues, right? This sort of protectionist sort of protect the people from things that, you know, we object to, and that extends to itself. Protect the world from Western liberal values. Protect Russia from all those things out there that you heard about in the speech. This Western American unilateral force that's ruining everything, like you heard in Putin's speech.
From gay Europe.
You name it. Decadence.
Explain the homophobia.
Bully. Well, it's a thing that Putin can say, this is what American values stand for, and this is why we should be against the United States. It's nothing personal, actually. It's essentially a great thing. We are Russia. We have conservative values. We have the Orthodox Church. They have this abomination, and they want us to be like them. We don't want to be like them. And people go, we don't want to. It was never a thing in the 90s, really, as time went on. It became an issue when Putin made it an issue.
We've got to get to his critique of us, and it seems to me there are two Putins here. I mean, there's the brute at home, the very successful politician, but there's also a critic who makes the Americans think twice about what we have done in a unipolar world, and it's a pretty unhappy record in Iraq, in Afghanistan. How do we put these two things together? As I read his long speech at the Valdai Club in Moscow just a few days ago, I mean, I kept wondering, who's writing this stuff for him? Somebody, some very sophisticated prose stylist, but also analyst, is in charge here.
Putin's a very astute observer. I remember the one time I did interview him. He was incredible. He understood where I was going. You know, he's not dumb, and he's got smart people working for him, and he's got what we used to call in the Cold War, whataboutism. If you say, you guys invaded Crimea, he says, no, no, we took back something that was ours. You made a new state out of Kosovo. You know, we say, you have no right to enter Ukraine. They, no, 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 no. You have no right to enter Iraq, Afghanistan. Bring your armies there. Change the political system. Take people out of power. Kill people. So whenever you look at what we're saying about Russia now, its territorial integrity has been violated by Russia because they entered Ukrainian soil and took it away. They can say, no, that's always been Russian soil. We belong there, whereas you guys are always going into countries and we can't do anything about it, and you don't let us tell you in the UN, no, don't do this. It's brilliant in a way because it's all true, if you look at it that way.
He's saying, apparently with seriousness, that a unipolar world doesn't work. That the end of the Soviet, the Cold War, in effect, was a tragedy for geopolitics, and that we've got
the biggest tragedy,
the greatest of the 20th century. But he also is saying something that that I hate to say, but a lot of Americans would agree with, that the United States, as the manager of all world affairs in a single kind of sort of end of history regime, is not working out. He says the unipolar world, the world that President Obama now manages, turned out to be too uncomfortable, heavy, and unmanageable a burden even for the self-proclaimed leader.
Yeah, Putin doesn't operate in a vacuum. What we all thought in 1991, look, I thought that would be the biggest thing in the history of the world in my lifetime. 1991, communism ends. Well, it turned out not to be, didn't it? 10 years later, something else happened. Right? That then ended up defining our world. Our thinking in 1991 that communism was over, Soviet communism defeated, the world is free now. And they're thinking, okay, finally we're going to live better and free. As it became clear that post-Soviet Russia didn't work out, that they felt like they were having their faces rubbed in the dirt, that the West was dominating. So we discovered that when we go into Afghanistan with troops and try to create democracy, or Iraq and try to create democracy, it doesn't really work. As our idea of the world order starts to fail, because in fact, it turns out we can't expand American-style democracy anywhere we want to. It doesn't always take, and it's tragic for us. So does their view of the world, that the West and its ideas actually aren't helping Russia. They're putting us down. They're trying to keep us in a small place where we really don't belong. We're Russia. Those two narratives intersect. And so it is true, because we realize now, 20 years later, 23, right, that in fact it didn't work out that way. History didn't end, and something bigger happened, and we're still reeling from the fact. I mean, we're not out of Iraq, are we? And we're still bombing in Syria. We're back in the Middle East in a way. And Putin looks at that and says, see, you shouldn't have put Russia down. Maybe things were better off when there was another power. But the question we should ask Putin is then, if it's a bipolar world, what are you, the other pole? Russia, with your failing economy and all you sell is natural resources and all of your revenue comes from that, all the tax revenue comes from that one stream of income. Really, the guy that should be the bipolar, the other pole, is China, the big, huge power. And every time Putin speaks, we know that there's one thing that he has that nobody else has, a big enough nuclear arsenal to face off against the United States. And that's it. And so it sounds empty. It sounds weak. At the same time that he's saying, we're here.
Look back on your own time in the 90s, David, and what happened toward the end of that, it seemed, golden decade. And critics in Russia remember it as a golden time. Masha Gessen writes in her book on Putin, The Man Without a Face, she writes, his inauguration as president in February 2000 was the beginning of the backward evolution of Russia. He ceased being the young democratic reformer that Berezovsky had invented. He was now the hoodlum turned iron-handed ruler. What happened?
What happened? In the 1990s, everything went south. Democracy didn't work. They came up with a pun that I can't say on the air for democracy, but basically it translates roughly into crapocracy. Democracy became a dirty word, sort of like you hear liberal here. There were shortages, there were lines, there were people didn't get paid on time, the ruble crashed, there was the war in Chechnya. Everybody says, that's post-Soviet democracy? We don't need that. Putin comes, he defeats the Chechens, he takes control, he managed to bring the oligarchs into line, and he basically is saying, see, I'm going to make Russia a great power, they're going to respect us again. And grudgingly, people slowly decide to buy into this. We have the ability to make money. We can travel overseas. As long as we play along with this regime, we're okay. And not only that, he's saying what we want to hear. Russians are not second-class citizens. Putin's annexation speech. We are Russians. We're going to defend Russians. You're good. That is something that a lot of people are willing to trade, the ability to elect somebody else and to get Putin out of power or his people out of power. They're willing to trade that for the sense that finally Russia is in somebody's hands. And if you're under 30 years old and you grew up with your mom crying because they had no pay in 1998, and now you see what Russia is, you say, yeah, it's not necessarily a free country, but we live so much better now under Putin than we did under Yeltsin's kleptocracy. And that's a huge difference. Somebody my age is saying, we had all that freedom and we lost it, and Putin is the reason. And that's the generation gap that they have right now.
Anna Aratunian, is that your generation? And what difference does generation make? Did you go through that sort of disenchantment?
You know, it's kind of different for me because I grew up in the United States and I lived in America during the 90s. I came back to Russia in 2002. I was already an adult and I started my journalism career then. It's not that I don't think I ever had any illusions about Putin. I never really so there's really nothing to get disenchanted by. As for the 90s, I also saw that I would visit Russia. I also had no illusions about democracy, that democracy was really going to happen after something like 1993 occurred, when as you correctly point out, Yeltsin goes against his own parliament. So,
Remind me why you went back, Anna.
It was just for personal reasons, but it's just because I grew up in Moscow. I was born there, and it just something just drew me there. There's something interesting about the place, about Russia, that I felt as a writer, as a journalist, I needed to be there to be able to study.
It draws you back.
David Philip, speak of this matter of generations. And what difference it made, sort of when you were born or when you came of age.
Me,
please.
Yeah, sure. If you grew up in the era where there was a Cold War and we worried that there would be nuclear war, that tanks would go through the Fulda Gap and we'd have a war in Germany, we were afraid. When I was 20, I worried about that. And you know, if you were 20 in 2002. You never thought about that. We were already, there was a time when we stopped aiming our nuclear weapons at each other. There was a time when Russians and American journalists, I was there. They were in factories disarming these weapons and turning them into, you know, concrete, disarming chemical weapons, things that are unthinkable now. The degree of cooperation to make the world safer, it was over. The Cold War was over. This opposition was over. At least that's how it seemed. And when suddenly, you know, You're 50 years old and you look back and say, wait a minute, I thought it was all over. I thought that the freedom was here. And now you're not allowed to, you can't blog, they shut you down. You can't go on the radio, you can't go on TV, you can't be in the newspaper. There's so many things you can't do. And as a result, you get a lot of intellectuals who are Russian leaving the place. And by the way, why do you come back? I lived there for 14 years. My children were born there. I love Russia. I can't help it. I go back there because I like to. It's not because I love Putin. It's not because I love everything about it. It just keeps dragging you back in. And I understand Anna, too, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't leave you alone. It's a place you fall in love with. I don't know what it is. Is it the fact that everybody can recite poetry? Is it the fact that classical music is excellent and it's free? You know, there's a thing there that attracts you to it. And to have it always be associated with this fear and this lack of freedom and everything. When you're in the streets of Moscow on a summer night and people are singing and playing bongos in the street and it's beautiful, you can forget it. I can understand how somebody would forget it. And then accidentally you walk across the street and the patriarch's car hits you. The patriarch gets wounded. You get sued. You go to jail. There's nothing you can do, even though you were the guy that got hit, because there is no recourse. The courts are fixed. There's no congressman you can call. There's no instance that can save you if you run afoul of these corrupt and all-powerful, you know, authorities. Now you're in trouble and there's nothing you can do. That's what's been lost here. You're in Russia. Suddenly, there is no recourse. There's no civic institution that can protect, you know, citizen X. And that can be me. That can be Anna. That can be you. That can be a Russian. That can be my son. That's what went wrong, is there is no more. And if you're 50 and you lived in the Soviet Union when that was the case, you say, you know what? In the Soviet Union, there was a minimal amount of protection for citizens. There was recourse. The Communist Party could help you out. The local, you know, bureaucracy could help you out. Right now in Russia, none of that exists.
Explain something. As the rule got more and more strong-armed, authoritarian in style, and in fact, a very, very lively protest culture survived for a long time.
Survived.
Explain that. I mean, reading the retrospectives on the Putin years, I mean, it's striking the courage with which individual, a lot of them journalists, but organizers, kept at it.
Yeah. One of my best friends is a guy who was a journalist. He became an activist because he can't be a journalist anymore, you know, and he's basically now a blogger. Of course, when the elections were basically stolen in 2008 and then again in 2010, and, you know, the movement of people going out in the street. Remember, what brought down the Soviet Union was President Yeltsin standing on a tank and hundreds of thousands of people cheering in the streets. One of them, again, I thought that was going to be the biggest thing in my lifetime. Russians do that. They're not this whole sort of stereotype that Russians want a strong hand and they're cowed and all that. That's baloney. However, when the authorities make it impossible to gather, when organizing this demonstration will get you arrested, when standing at the demonstration will get you arrested, sooner or later people realize I'm beating my head against the wall and it's just going to make my life worse. Maybe I just won't do that anymore. And the demonstrations got smaller and smaller and smaller. And my friend Sergei, who used to organize them, now sits and blogs about whatever he can.
The demonstrations surged, the protests surged again in 2012. And some people felt that, you know, Putin took a kind of warning note. What's to say about that 2012 in retrospect?
Well, and what happened afterwards is there's so many different ways that you get arrested for just being there, and they put you, you know, they make it very hard to gather now. And I mean, Sochi was a great example. They set apart this protest square. The bureaucracy, in order to be able to protest in the Olympic protest park, was impossible. There was basically no way to do it legally. They've basically closed that route. Now, will people go out there and try to demonstrate? Yes, they'll get arrested. And then Putin, with his 80% popularity rating, will come out and see what happens when people, you know, they become delinquents because they're believing the American Western decadent, you know, idea. I'm exaggerating, but essentially that's what's taken place. It's become very difficult to go out in the street and demonstrate. But you know what else? In the United States, we have the freedom to do it, and we don't do it.
What's his fear of that kind of street power, people power, to this day?
His fear is that if I really give everybody a choice and don't tell them I am Russia and without me there is no Russia, and give them a chance and give them candidates, am I really going to win after 15 years of this? Can't have that. Can't let that come to a vote.
Interesting. You make it sound like a plausible danger. And we know all of these things, power and popularity, are fickle. We're talking about Vladimir Putin on Open Source. Coming up, the Cold War context from 1989.
Good evening, everyone. From the west side of the Berlin Wall at the Brandenburg Gate, I'm Tom Brokaw. The Brandenburg Gate, of course, is in East Berlin, and the sound that you hear and what you're seeing tonight, not hammers and sickles, but hammers and chisels as young people take down this wall bit by bit.
25 years later, the story continues. This hour, three ways of looking at Russia's President Vladimir Putin, with David Filipov, Anna Arutunyan, and the scholar at Harvard this year, Mary Elise Cerotti, who wrote a celebrated book of hindsight on the end of the Cold War, titled 1989, The Struggle to Create Post-Cold War Europe. She's got a new book out on the collapse, the accidental opening of the Berlin Wall. Remind us. Mary Cerotti, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, that clip with Tom Brokaw, that was the moment that millions of Americans found out that the wall opened. But the irony is that it was not planned. And if this weren't radio, if this were television and you could see that clip, you could see that Tom Brokaw is standing in the foreground saying, it's now possible to move freely across the wall. And just behind him, East Germans are using water cannons to prevent just that from happening. So it's a very paradoxical image.
But there, in hindsight, was Vladimir Putin.
Yes.
Serving Moscow and the KGB. When his regime started falling apart in front of his eyes, and Tom Brokaw's too. I mean, one senses that that is still a burning wound in his head.
Yes, Putin was serving as a KGB agent in Dresden, not in Berlin. Dresden was a city in the south, but obviously he was in East Germany for these fateful events, and they have left an imprint on him. When the German chancellor, Angela Merkel, calls him, she can, of course, speak to him in Russian, and he can respond in German. This is something that still has an impact on him to this day. Political scientists sometimes like to talk about something called an operational code. And the reason I bring that up, it's the idea that a world leader's guiding principles are actually set when generally he, is younger, and perhaps in his 20s or 30s. Vladimir Putin was in his mid-30s when he was in East Germany. The idea is that your operational code is formed when you're a younger man, and then you have the chance to put it into effect when you're in power, often decades later. So you see this kind of delayed effect. So I think that Vladimir Putin's operational code was very much shaped by the end of the Cold War. And so it's important, if you want to understand what's going on today, to understand those events as well.
You've written extensively and with great authority on a so-called promise or commitment that was made by the Bush administration at the end of the Cold War, not to move NATO one inch in the direction of Russia. This is now a very important subject. Explain what did happen, who wrote it down, who disagrees, and the impact to this moment.
Sure. This is a hugely controversial issue, and it's, of course, not just a historical debate. It is one of the motivations for what Putin is doing today. He does not like the eastward movement of NATO. and the 2008 war in Georgia was largely an effort to prevent NATO from potentially going into Georgia, and obviously he does not want it to move into Ukraine as well. The issue goes back to 1989 and 1990. At the one end of the spectrum, Russians claimed that they got an ironclad guarantee that NATO would never expand in exchange for agreeing to allow German unification. And it's important to remember, despite all of the problems in the Soviet Union, the economy collapsing, the instability, the Soviet Union was still one of the victor powers of World War II. And so it had,
it had,
the Nazis had surrendered unconditionally. And so the Soviet Union was one of the four victor powers along with the U.S., France, and Britain, and so it had unconditional legal rights. They had been somewhat modified, but essentially were still in force. And it had nearly 400,000 troops in former East Germany. So the West, despite the wall coming down, could not just simply declare Germany unified. The Soviet Union, Moscow, had to give up those rights and withdraw the troops. And so the question is, what would it want in exchange? And there's a spectrum of opinions now that range, on the one hand, from the Russians saying, well, what we got was an ironclad guarantee NATO would never expand. That's one end of the spectrum. And at the other spectrum, end of the spectrum, of Americans saying that's complete nonsense, it never came up. Well, if you actually go and look at the archives in the relevant countries, and these are the archives that are the basis for my books that you kindly mentioned, the answer is somewhere in between, that there were verbal promises that NATO would not move one inch eastward, not even to East Germany, that the line would stay right where it was in 1989 and Germany would be half in and half out of NATO, as ridiculous as that sounds. There were verbal promises to that effect, and on the basis of them, Gorbachev gave the green light for German unification to start with monetary union. But he didn't get anything written down. And then the negotiations moved on, and in the end, he ended up in a very weak negotiating position, and he signed accords that contained no such promise, no such pledge. So it's a very complicated answer, but the kernel of it is that there were these verbal promises, even though they weren't written down. And to this day, there's still a great deal of resentment about those.
Well, the spirit of the commitment is crucial to this moment. John Mearsheimer at Chicago, a geostrategist we admire enormously, writes in Foreign Affairs recently that the United States and NATO are to blame for the Ukraine crisis, that we created it. Precisely because we have advanced both the market and the military alliance steadily eastward. He says Putin's actions around Crimea and Ukraine should be easy to comprehend. Ukraine specifically is a buffer state of enormous strategic importance to Russia. This is Mearsheimer writing.
Yep.
No Russian leader would tolerate a military alliance that was Moscow's mortal enemy until recently moving into Ukraine, nor would any Russian leader stand idly by while the West helped install a government there that was determined to integrate Ukraine into the West. We've provoked it, he says. What about it?
Right. Yes, that's a very strong statement by John Mearsheimer. He's not the only person, however, to criticize NATO expansion. No less a thinker than George Kennan, the man who came up with the idea of containment back in the 1940s, a leading diplomat and State Department official, also, in later years, criticized NATO expansion as an enormous strategic mistake for many of the reasons that John Mearsheimer describes. And the origins of that expansion I see as going back to the George H.W. Bush administration, not just in the Clinton era, but in the George H.W. Bush administration. And it was part of a larger effort to, by design, leave the Soviet Union, later Russia, on the periphery of post-Cold War Europe, to perpetuate U.S. predominance in European security.
I got to say, no less a mind, no less a friend of all of ours, Mikhail Gorbachev said almost exactly the same point in Berlin the other day on the anniversary. He said there was a commitment not to expand east. He said, quoting Gorbachev, "Euphoria and triumphalism went to the heads of Western leaders, taking advantage of Russia's weakening and the lack of a counterweight. They claimed monopoly leadership and domination in the world." How do we?
Well, it's important to understand the historical events. When he talks of a commitment, again, there was nothing in writing, and indeed, Moscow ended up signing accords that did not include any agreement. So there are verbal offerings during negotiations, but they do not actually materialize into a formal commitment. I think it's important to maintain that. But if you kind of step back from the details and look at the spirit of Gorbachev's speech, it still shows that the resentment of this time period is still very much a factor in international relations. He was, of course, speaking at a very emotive occasion, the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. He was flown to Berlin as an honored guest to give a speech. It was obviously very high profile. So it's quite remarkable that his speech struck such a sad note.
But your sense is also just vivid in the mind of Putin to this moment. Three things. I mean, in 1989, Russia's been left out in the cold. Bye-bye. H.W. Bush himself is quoted saying, to hell with Russia, we prevailed. And third, it's a sorry history since then of might-have-beens and decline in the Russian economy in lots and lots of ways. Does this help David Filipov?
Well, let's also remember that in that period when Eastern Europe became free of Russia's domination, remember that part of the equation, on that sugar high of freedom, all these states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, that had less history as being part of Soviet communism, Russian communism. They didn't have people who were against the idea of freedom, democracy, privatization. They wanted to join Europe. They wanted to be capitalists. And they all said, take us in, or else Russia will come back and dominate us again. Who was NATO to say no to that? That's how these countries got in. I was in Poland the day that Poland was accepted into NATO. Universal jubilation. Why? Because Russia and Germany had run over the place so many different times, right? European forces, Russia, you know, dividing it up. These countries fed that notion that we had that not only is history over, and not only is there a new world order, these people all want to run to ours. And maybe when they all join it and see how great it is, Russia will also see how great it is and we'll have a better relationship with them. Now, do people really believe that? Not necessarily. But that idea that we aren't expanding NATO eastward to threaten Russia, people want to come and join us because it's great here. Hey, Russia, join us too, was the sort of surface of that. And, you know, who was going to say no?
Anna Arutyunyan, what's the street sense in Russia of this responsibility for so much unhappiness since 89?
There is a lot of blame on the West. I mean, just the sentiment in the street. And in fact, the protest movement, the very vibrant protest movement that we saw in 2011, 2012, a lot of people I saw turning out to those protests and speaking to them. Right now, they are saying that Crimea is ours, and they're saying that they're fed up with what they see as Western and particularly U.S. posturing. So they fully buy into this. These sentiments were very latent even before Putin started fully exploiting them on as a part of foreign policy and as the key point of his domestic rhetoric. But yes, these sentiments are there. It's understandable on a personal level. It's kind of mixed with envy almost. On the one hand, you've got a lot of immigrants, you've got a lot of people moving to America and saying, I don't want anything more to do with Russia. On the other hand, you've got those who've remained behind kind of saying, well, there's this sense of disenfranchisement, almost an envy.
What are we on the verge of here? I mean, we could have tanks in, more tanks, Russian tanks in Ukraine tonight, and who knows what the European and American responses will be. What are the ways of softening this confrontation, of neutralizing Ukraine somehow, or finding some diplomatic conversation between I'm thinking of the picture in the New York Times this week of Putin strutting right past President Obama in China, all of them in sort of Chinese dress, but thinking, could these people ever sit down and talk?
Well, if I could actually add, as if we don't have enough to be worried about already, but to add one more item actually from the New York Times, I was very alarmed to see today Russia announcing, according to the New York Times, that it will reduce its participation in joint efforts to secure nuclear materials on Soviet territory. Sergei Kirienko, the head of a state nuclear company, indicating that to Obama administration officials. Those were path-breaking efforts, many of them done by Harvard scholars, among them Matthew Bunn, people who have been trying to help contain those loose nukes that could be frightening in so many ways, and it is deeply worrying if those efforts are going to falter.
Is he in a, dare I say, trapped in a spiral of escalation?
I certainly hope we're not at the beginning of that, but it seems like that might be possible. David?
Well, I mean, let's just go a step or two ahead, because we've been following events. The United States and NATO have been basically reacting to what's happening in Ukraine. You have these states that are NATO states where there are Russian populations that are complaining about mistreatment. Putin's doctrine right now seems to be where Russians are being mistreated, we will support them. And the country says, yes, yes. Well, in Riga, in Vilnius, in Tallinn, which are part of the Baltic states, that noise is being heard. It happened in Georgia when there was a Russian-speaking minority that said it was being mistreated by Georgia. It's in Moldova. We should be thinking about that next move. You don't want, say, for example, little green men to start appearing in Riga, Latvia, and nobody knows what to do about it. Because if there were a war that began there, if there were an invasion there, we have to go to war according to the NATO doctrine. Hmm. You can't let that happen. You can't even let that begin to happen. That's the real thing here. And for every one of us that's saying that, there are Russians who say they know that this is all an American plan. Americans shot down the plane. Americans are trying to make this happen. This is an American plan to put Russia down. We have to keep fighting. So they're thinking about that next move. The American and European powers have to start thinking about how not to let this thing spread to the countries that we're actually obliged to protect.
Mary Cerruti.
Just to expand on what David said, just for your listeners, he's referring there to the Article 5 guarantee that applies to NATO territory. In essence, that's a guarantee that says every member of the NATO alliance shall treat an attack on anyone as an attack on themselves. That, of course, includes the United States. So the idea is that if this struggle somehow moves into the Baltics, which are NATO territory, then Article 5 guarantees would apply, which don't apply to Ukraine since Ukraine is not a NATO.
And to you, the listener, what this matters is you are thinking about all these places for the first time. Estonia, Latvia, why do we care? Well, the second it happens in a NATO country, we, the United States, are at war. It's not Syria or ISIS or something where we can decide if we go in. We have to. We're obliged to it. And then suddenly we're fighting a war with Russia.
Although, of course, there is this question of, will the U.S. actually fight? The Economist had that as its cover question a couple of months ago. Will the U.S. actually fight? Will the U.S. actually fulfill Article 5 guarantees for Tallinn?
I'm wondering about initiatives from this side. And I'm also reading John Mearsheimer. He is for the de-NATOization of our policy around Ukraine. Work it out as a buffer, sort of the Austria, of the Cold War. But he says Putin, no doubt, has autocratic tendencies, but he's saying don't underestimate him. He is a first-class strategist who should be feared and respected by anyone challenging him on foreign policy. The pictures tell that story, too.
And is the end game, then, if we're thinking like Putin, thinking ahead, no NATO? What if the world says, what if the United States says, you know what, why do we need that thing and all the obligations? Let the Germans figure it out. That is an end game that is potentially the one that Putin has. Let's get rid of the NATO alliance. Let's persuade the Americans they don't need it and those obligations. Why are we going to fight for Latvians?
That I think is a fairly unlikely outcome. But the word that I've been hearing from my friends in the State Department is Finlandization. You can't really say that if you're a State Department official publicly, but that would be the best of a series of bad options. But I don't think NATO is going to disappear.
No, it's what you'd like to see. It's not going to necessarily happen.
Right. Why not invite Moscow and Putin into NATO?
Been done. Been tried.
Thank you, Anna Arutunyan. Thank you, David Filipov and Mary Cerruti. Thanks also to Steve Kutkin, the Russia expert and Stalin biographer who sat down with us earlier this week. We'll have a much longer conversation with him, from the young Stalin to trouble in Ukraine today, on our website, radioopensource.org. We're going out on a 1992 cover of the Paul McCartney classic Back in the USSR by the Russian pop group Baba Yaga. Our show was produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, with help from Maria Jose Fabre and Rebecca Panofka. Mary McGrath is our cultural commissar. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Back in U.S., back in U.S., back in USSR.